But first, just for listeners who may not be aware, can you tell us what is the OJRC?
Sure. So we're a nonprofit just entering our 10th year this year, in fact. And we house a number of projects that are meant to really provide direct client services to otherwise neglected areas of legal services in Oregon. So we have an innocence project where we help people get actual claims of innocence filed in court if it's feasible. We have an immigration rights project, a women's justice project for those attorneys actually go into Poppy Creek and provide direct legal services for any and all things that otherwise might not be available. And there's we now have a youth rights project that's blossoming, and also the civil rights project.
Great. Yeah, I know OJRC has like been the go-to organization for a lot of prison rights activists for many years now. So we're so grateful that you exist. So we'd like to talk tonight about what's going on with COVID in the prisons. We've done a bunch of shows about COVID here on Prison Pipeline. We've talked to lots of folks from OJRC, but obviously this is an ongoing issue. It started last spring when there was a lawsuit that was brought by the OJRC, and we were talking about trying to encourage the governor at that time to take the most medically vulnerable and provide for safe social distancing within Oregon's prisons. And that didn't really happen. And it's gone all the way through till recently, where there's finally been a federal, a judge ordering that the prisoners be vaccinated, which was, a great ruling. I'd like to know if it's actually being implemented. But anyway, so if we could start with just let's have a broad discussion first, just what's going on with COVID-19 in the prisons?
Sure. So yeah, you did a great job kind of teeing up where this case started, which was basically, hey, we knew that ODOC was not going to A, release people, or B, allow for social distancing. And those were really going to be the most crucial strategies to mitigating the spread of the disease while people are serving their sentences. So, from the get-go, you wanted to have a court order in place that ensured that those things would be provided for. There's legal reasons why it's hard to get releases done in any kind of expeditious way. Congress passed a law in the 90s called the Prison Litigation Reform Act, basically making release the last possible thing you can ask for, and you can only really get there unless other things are done first. So we wanted to start with the other things. So somehow find a way to provide for social distancing, increase mask wearing, provide for hygiene. And unfortunately, the judge didn't agree with us on the ripeness of the legal facts that we had at that time. We're talking May of 2020 when at that time, I mean, it was serious then, and much smaller now in comparison, I guess, but there was a serious outbreak in the Oregon State Penitentiary, our oldest prison, our unhealthiest prison in a lot of ways, and a person had already died. And so it seems it was serious certainly at that time, but I don't think it was quite understood by ODOC or maybe the court that this was a train that was going to go off the tracks very soon. And we saw that not long after. We had outbreaks in Snake River in Ontario, EOCI in Pendleton, and those were later exacerbated by forest fire evacuation. So if you can recall this hell of a year, four prisons were evacuated and put into two prisons. And what else did you expect? Cramming that many people together and foregoing the basic COVID protections that people were struggling to just maintain. Now, all through this period, and this is something we've learned through the course of discovery, discovery being the legal process of gathering evidence in your civil case, we've learned that correctional officers were not following the social distancing guidances or the mask wearing guidances. ODOC knew that was a problem, and yet they didn't put in a mask mandate until July. And even then, COs, other correctional staff have flouted those rules. And so you have a system-wide shirking of responsibility to prevent the spread of COVID in our prisons. Coupling that with other mitigation strategies that are really just non-strategies, you're going to have the mass carnage that we've seen in the last couple of months. So that's kind of brought us to the current period, which where the case is now, after we weren't successful in getting a court order to allow for social distancing, we added a damages claim. So all the folks who did or would contract COVID-19 would be a class member, kind of like, if Starbucks was stealing your nickels every time you bought a latte, you would be a class member. And we've been advocating for folks' rights through that avenue. If you're not going to get the carrot, you're going to get the stick. So once we got news of a vaccine, of course, we have another thing that we can possibly advocate for. And here we are now, months later, 3,400 people infected, 42 dead. This is the best hope that all parties in this case have to prevent further harm. And that wasn't lost on the judge. The judge certainly knew the gravity of the situation. We had a hearing over 2 hours or so, and it ended with the judge really kind of memorializing and eulogizing the folks that we lost over the last year, and it was very touching. And later that day, the judge ruled that basically the state already made clear people who live in congregate living situations needed to be vaccinated with priority 1A, and prisoners were entirely ignored for priority 1A. So this order fixed that.
Why did it take the action of a judge in order to do the most obvious, thing, which is give people who are in prison vaccines? I mean, I've been watching the vaccine rollout, and every time I saw the guidelines, prisoners were not on the list. And it's just such an abrogation of our responsibility as a civil society to just leave people in these conditions where they're facing imminent death. Why did it take so long for this? Why did it take the action of a judge in order for this to happen?
It's so obvious, right? Like you're saying, I mean, we understood that people in congregate living situations needed to be vaccinated. We prioritized that. We vaccinated folks in the Oregon State Hospital, people who, a lot of whom are waiting trial as well, and are being rehabilitated to be able to assist in their trials. And so the only apparent reason why they weren't included is because prisoners are second-class citizens in our society. They are not cared for politically or just within the community enough. I mean, they're cared for by folks like us and our loved ones and certainly advocates and the people on the inside. But we, as a society, have not cared for our community members half as well as we should have. in the first place. And I'm reminded of a formerly incarcerated poet, Reginald Dwayne Betts. He wrote about how, you know, we don't have a normative idea of how it is that we incarcerate people. We, you know, there's not a baseline rule. This is how you confine somebody. All we have is our own personal biases and beliefs about the people we're incarcerating, and that's what drives our prison policies. And so for too many people, we think, oh, these are all 12,000 people in ODOC's custody are murderers, and you know, they've consigned themselves to death. You know, we're not gonna lift the finger. I certainly don't believe that about anybody.
These are people's family members. These are people's right. Fathers, their mothers, their children, their loved ones. These are members of our community.
Precisely. And we need to grow up. We need to grow up past this mentality of, you know, the worst days of all these people's lives have become, you know, de facto death sentences. And that can't be how we continue to operate and kind of grow a sense of morality.
We're talking tonight with Juan Chavez with the Oregon Justice Resource Center. Juan is with the Civil Rights Program or the Civil Rights Project of the OJRC. And we're talking tonight about, it's kind of a year into COVID-19 in the prisons. And so we're just kind of talking about the last year, what's been working, what didn't work, and what has the OJRC been doing? So Juan, what is the status of vaccinations right now in the prisons? Do you know, has everybody been vaccinated? Are they starting vaccinations? What's going on with that?
Sure. I'll back up, and this is probably an interesting point that kind of goes to what we were talking about earlier. But ODOC actually vaccinated about 1,200 people in January, and they later claimed that that was in fact a mistake. They apparently misread OHA's rules and did the right thing. I just wish that ODOC would make more mistakes that actually help people, but that clearly doesn't happen. But what that also demonstrated is that ODOC had the capacity and ability to vaccinate people quickly. This happened over the span of one weekend, and to get a fairly high acceptance rate. They offered it to folks who were 60 and older, and some younger folks who were medically vulnerable. And they had an 85% acceptance rate, which is far better than the community at this point. Shows that people understand this is my ticket to protection, why I'm absolutely taking it. So when the judge ruled the way that she did, what she said was, prisoners are 1A, group 2 now. And what that does then is just open up the world of 1A vaccines for prisoners. So, you know, part of this goes into the mysterious process in which our state is divvying up vaccines and prioritizing and distributing them. But essentially, these vaccines are coming from the 1A pile and being distributed in shipments across all of ODOC. So the first shipment went out last week. That was 5,000 doses. There's a little, you know, vials versus doses administered. That's another whole spreadsheet to look at. But essentially, the first round was going to be offered to people who needed it as quickly as possible, so older folks and people with medical disabilities. Across the board, fairly good acceptance rate, 70% or so. Some of the other facilities have had lower acceptance rates. And from what we're hearing from folks on the inside is that's likely attributable to bad communication, bad vaccine-related education, and frankly, a well-understood institutional distrust. And this is something that, frankly, both sides of this lawsuit want to figure out and fix, but this is several decades for some folks is built up defense to ODOC's BS, frankly. I mean, I don't blame somebody for not trusting ODOC to have their best interests in mind when they've demonstrated time and time again that they don't. And we're now in a position where we need ODOC to step up and provide adequate vaccine education to allow people to feel comfortable getting that vaccine. So that first shipment of 5,000, the governor has ordered that people in jails and also OYA are now part of 1A as well. And future shipments will also be going to those jails and community correctional facilities. And 5,000 doses should have been going to ODOC every week until everybody who's been offered a vaccine has accepted one, or you know, they're not being forced to accept the vaccine, but everybody should be offered within the next week or so. We've had obviously the severe ice storm, which has delayed shipments from across the country. You know, it's an act of God. I don't think we can quite account for every last one of those things to happen, but hopefully we're back on track next week.
Great, thank you. We're talking tonight with Juan Chavez from the OJRC about COVID-19 in the prisons. Juan, we've got about 10 minutes left. I want to make sure to get to a couple of things. One is going back to that lawsuit. When the lawsuit was first filed, it was intended to be filed, you know, to cover people who in the future we knew were going to get COVID-19. What rights do those people have? I mean, the 3,400 people who have been infected with COVID-19 in the prisons, which we know it affects people and it can have very, very serious and long-term effects on a person's health. What kind of protections did the lawsuit cover in terms of monetary damages for people who were infected with COVID-19 and had really serious like effects because of it?
Sure. So we're still in the phase where we need to have the judge certify whether or not we're a class action. We made class action allegations, but until the judge says you're a class, we can't quite reach out to everybody and say we're now your class lawyers. We're advocating for people's interests right now, and we have a decent enough working relationship with state to do occasional advocacy on things. But you know, when it is that we get to the point where we're talking damages, that we're probably a long ways off. These kind of cases, federal court to start with, those kind of cases take a long time. Class actions take even longer. All cases take years. So, you know, yeah, you're in terms of damages, I mean, it's certainly gonna differ for everybody's experience. And a lot of that has to account also for what we don't know about COVID. What are the long-term effects of contracting it? Like, you know, let's say you're asymptomatic, but there is suddenly a neurological disorder that you've developed, or a heart condition. I'm not saying that those things are happening quite yet, but you know, if you're trying to determine what is true compensation, what makes somebody whole in this circumstance, those are things you got to account for. So, and of course, we know that 42 people have died, so their damages are certainly much higher than somebody who was asymptomatic. The whole goal of class actions is to provide collective power to individual plaintiffs who might not otherwise have that. So you can have the kind of leverage to get a good result better than you could when you're on your own. And so when you get those kind of aggregate damages, then you're gonna have to figure out how to apportion those. And that's for another day.
Thank you. We're talking with Juan Chavez from the OJRC about COVID-19 and Oregon's prisons. Juan, we've got time left for about one more question. And what I'd really like to get to just in the last 5 minutes is, having 3,400 of the 12,000 plus incarcerated persons in the state of Oregon contract COVID and having 42 people die, knowing that there was a lawsuit ahead of time that could have created some kind of social distancing and the governor chose not to act on that. All of these issues really create, and plus everyone who's incarcerated right now has been isolated, almost completely isolated from most of the contact that they had with the outside world for the last year, from their families, from the religious and spiritual services that give their lives meaning, from classes. And so I'd like to talk for just a couple of minutes. Maybe you're hearing things. I want to know, how are things for people who are inside right now? It must be a very, very stressful time in addition to dealing with this deadly contagious disease. Having lost all of your supports while you're incarcerated must be really challenging. How are people surviving right now in our state institutions?
I can't begin to imagine the type of pressure, anxiety, and terror that one must be experiencing, seeing what you're seeing. I mean, I think the hardest conversations I've had with people are those for people who have watched their friends die, just there in their cell, and wondering if they might be next just because CO Joe doesn't want to wear a mask because he thinks COVID isn't real. It's a lot of these guys are so close to release. I don't think enough people understand just how 95% of folks are going to be your neighbors coming out of ODOC in some short months. People just want to get through it, and they're doing their best to keep themselves occupied and safe in that period, but there's just nowhere to be safe. So I think it's that sense of insecurity that really kind of eats at people. There's been periods where some facilities have had to go into full lockdown, and here's something that I heard some months ago. I mean, there's people who would rather get COVID than go into solitary confinement. That says a lot about what confinement is actually like. I think a lot of people have kind of glibly said, oh, we're in prison right now while we're under home lockdown. No, you ain't. that's not anything like prison. And also, there's something worse than prison, and it's solitary confinement. And there's been periods where some prisons have had to go into full lockdown, and even the superintendents and guards kind of understand this is killing people. This is having a long-term effect on people's mental health in a way that's physiological. You can tell that their health is declining, and it makes everything unsafe suddenly. So, all incarceration, in my opinion, and in my study, is torture. I don't think we should have prisons, frankly. And this pandemic has only highlighted that point. That's not what this legal case is about. I want to be clear, But we need to more generally grapple with this idea that prisons aren't effective and they're dangerous. And this is no way that any mature society should handle people who have violated its rules.
Thank you so much, Juan. It's really been a pleasure talking to you. We've been talking today with Juan Chavez from the Oregon Justice Resource Center. Juan, if people would like to find out more about the OJRC and their work and your work, where can they find it?
Find us on the World Wide Web, OJRC.info.
Great. Thank you so much. We really appreciate having you. Thank you so much and have a good night.
Yeah, you too.
Recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.